You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
In ancient Greek literature, the Trojans were derided for reliance on the bow and arrow, an action-at-a-distance weapon, instead of using hand-to-hand combat. This point is made by Barbara Ehrenreich in her foreword to Medea Benjamin's new book titled Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. And as Ehrenreich also comments, drones are the ultimate action-at-a-distance weapon, where aggressors target people in Pakistan and Afghanistan while hiding thousands of miles away in Nevada. Well, we've reached Medea Benjamin this morning to learn more about drone warfare. Good morning, Medea, and welcome back to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And warm congratulations on your book, which is definitely an eye-opener and, I would say, essential reading.
Great.
One thing you point out in your book, something that was an eye-opener for me, is that most of the drones aren't operated by the U.S. military. So who does use them?
Most of the drones have been operated by the CIA, which is not a military organization. It's not an organization that has any rules of the game in terms of the necessity to comply with international rules of war. It's by nature a secretive organization. By international law, members of the CIA involved in legal combat like this would be defined as unlawful combatants, a term that the U.S. has used so much for describing Taliban, and they would be legitimate targets. So, yes, it's very disturbing that the non-military or civilian agency, the CIA, would be given not only its own fleet of drones, but the leeway to kill people on a hit list and kill people simply on the basis of suspicious behavior.
And I don't know if memory serves me, so correct me if I'm wrong. I think you mentioned also that organizations like Blackwater, which has a new branding name but is the same contracted force, also have been using these.
That's right, and they have been using them in conjunction with both the military and the CIA, and that too is particularly disturbing. It seems they are involved on every level in terms of training the pilots, the maintenance of the drones, and involved in the actual kill loop, another patently illegal thing according to international law.
Now, maybe we could go more broadly into the issue of international law. Has this violation become much discussed in public, aside from the book where you raised this?
When I was doing the book, Mordecai, it was hard to get information because these are secret programs and our congressional representatives weren't allowed to talk about them, and for the longest time the administration didn't talk about it either. But suddenly there's just been a boom in all things drone. We have a piece in the New York Times that came out on May 29th where administration officials themselves are for the first time publicly talking about the drone program. We have the media that is suddenly interested in this, and we have a convergence of interests on what's happening overseas with the threat of drones becoming a commonplace here in the United States over our own skies. So I think the timing of the book was great because as I go around the country speaking to audiences, there's a newfound interest in drones.
When we say that their use violates international law, what's the reasoning for that?
The U.S. is justifying its use of drones on the basis of the right to self-defense. But that right to self-defense is very narrowly defined in international law, that it has to be an imminent danger, that the enemy has to be given a chance to surrender, that there has to be proportionality, and the lives being saved would be greater than the lives being potentially lost. And all of these are violated with the drone program. The U.S. has so stretched this definition of self-defense to really be have nothing to do with the definition according to international law.
So when we say it's a violation of international law, people who use it then are open to the charge of being war criminals?
Well, I would think so. The U.S. is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court, because that's for other people's war criminals, not our own war criminals, including those of the past Bush administrations. But it certainly would seem that the violations that are being carried out by the Obama administration and the mass killing that is being conducted by both the CIA and the military in places that the U.S. has not even declared war would certainly seem to be under the category of war crimes.
And that's in countries like Yemen, Somalia?
Yes, that's right.
The New York Times said that Obama literally does have a list of names and consults one of his legal advisors and then checks off a name, and that it becomes a targeted person for drone assassination or targeted assassination, as they try to refer to it. Sort of documented?
Well, it's been documented from the horse's mouth, in the sense that it's come directly from the administration. And what's particularly horrifying to me is that the leak of how this kill list is determined seems to have been part of an election strategy to show the voters of the United States, and particularly the independent voters that this administration is courting, that Obama is a tough guy when it comes to national security, that he can meet with his advisors on Terror Tuesdays, look through portraits that resemble baseball cards, decide who to put on the kill list, be the prosecutor, judge, executioner, all in one. And let's not forget that President Obama is a constitutional lawyer as well as a Nobel Peace Prize winner, and that he does this with ease. So, yes, this is the picture painted by the White House itself.
Despite this transparent illegality, Obama is an enthusiast. You've explained one dimension of it. It has an electoral appeal for him. But what else is it that distinguishes this from, let's say, the approach of the Bush administration before towards, quote-unquote, the enemy?
There was such an outcry under the Bush administration from people in the Democratic Party, people who would self-define as liberal or progressive, to the horrendous Bush policies of capturing people and throwing them into Guantanamo in indefinite detention, the practice of extraordinary rendition, sending people to other parts of the world where they were known to be tortured. And yet one wonders, where is the outcry against the Obama administration for policies that say, let's not put people into Guantanamo, that's messy, then we have to deal with trials. Should they be civilian trials? Should they be military trials? Let's do it the clean way, and that's just kill them.
So there's the question also of this political expediency. There's the question of illegality. What about the morality of the use of drones?
I was quite surprised when I was writing the book that there was so few writings and people speaking out from the faith-based community, because one would think that this would be central to the doctrines of people who focus on ethical issues. Here we are supposedly so determined to fight this enemy that is so dangerous, but we are not willing to put our own soldiers at risk, and we are willing to put at risk the non-combatants of our enemies. which violates the basic policies of just war. And so few of our leaders in the faith-based community have said anything about this. So one of the things I'm trying to do as I travel around with the book is to really get this discussion going and encourage leaders of different faiths to speak out against this. Within the military, it's interesting because there is talk about how cowardly this is to be fighting people by remote control, refusing to put yourself on the line. But firing a Hellfire missile from a PlayStation in an air-conditioned room in an ergonomically comfy chair, and willingly killing somebody's wife and their children in the process as well. So I do have a chapter on the ethics and morality of this, but I'm anxious to get many more people in our communities to be speaking out from this ethical point of view.
One of the figures you put in your book is the one about the number of human beings involved in a mission for a drone as compared with missions with piloted aircraft. And I'm wondering maybe you could just share that with us. It sort of took me aback. I sort of thought, well, the drone's pilotless, it must be, and it's all this automatic, blah, blah, blah. It must be really low human energy involvement in actually carrying out the killing. But it seems it's not at all.
Yes, it's perhaps counterintuitive because you think you're saving the job of a pilot, not having them in the cockpit, and these drones are sold to us as a way to make war on the cheap. But when you look into it, it really is not the case. There are so many people that are involved in setting one drone up in the air for a day that is quite astonishing. There are the people that are needed to pilot the drone. There are people who are needed to launch the drone in the bases where the drone is physically located. There are people who are needed to look through the endless hours of video that are being taken by these drones. And so, yes, I too was astonished to find out that the Air Force itself said that 168 people were needed just to keep one Predator drone in the air for 24 hours. And when you look at the even larger Global Hawk, the surveillance drone, that number jumps to 300 people. So this is quite labor intensive. And the other thing that we're not told about these drones is how often they crash. The Air Force admitting that a third of their drones crash. And so while they might be, quote, cheap to buy, you have to keep buying them. And for every hour in the air, they require 1 hour of maintenance.
Your book starts with a chapter on the growth market in the development and the use of drones. Maybe you can sketch some of that in terms of numbers, size, countries that have them.
Drones really have come into their own post 9/11. They've been around for decades, but it was really the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq that gave the big growth spurt. In the Pentagon, there were only about 50 drones in the year 2000. Today, there's over 7,000 drones. Now, these come in all shapes and sizes, and the vast majority of those 7,000 would be smaller drones like the ones a soldier could launch from their backpack, and they would be surveillance drones. But, of course, it also includes the Predator and the Reaper drones that are the ones used to kill. The U.S. is number one producer and user of drones. And in terms of lethal drones, the number two is Israel, that used them extensively in the invasion of the Gaza Strip in the year 2008-2009. Of the 1,400 people killed at that time, over 800 were killed with drones. Israel is the number one exporter of drones, exporting 85% of the world's drones to over 50 different countries. And then coming up from behind is China, who probably won't stay behind for long because they see this tremendous growth market. and they are producing several dozen different types of drones. So there is an arms race out there in the world of drones, and it is a multi-billion dollar business.
One of the eager people to use the drones, you report in your book, are police departments in the United States for doing surveillance, but more than surveillance, it seems.
Well, yes, and I think it's particularly disturbing the way the drone manufacturers are drooling when they think that there are 18,000 police departments in the United States, and wouldn't they like to sell drones to every single one of them? And with the problem of the squeezing of budgets here in the United States because of the financial crisis, they've gone to Homeland Security Department and said, let's start giving out grants to police departments to use drones. And the possible uses of drones are for surveillance, and in fact they can be equipped with things like thermal imaging and facial recognition, but also for attaching weapons like stun guns and beanbag firing guns, grenade launchers, tear gas, rubber bullets, 12-gauge shotguns. There's all kinds of things that can be attached to these drones, and it's very scary to think about the possibility of every police department in the United States having their own drones.
You report in your book that Obama has directed the Aviation Authority in the United States to loosen up its regulations so that more of these low-flying drones can occupy the airspace.
That's right. Right now, the Federal Aviation Administration has been giving out permits for drones very reluctantly because they know that these drones are dangerous, that they crash so often. But they are now mandated by the Congress and the executive branch to open up the U.S. airspace entirely to both commercial and law enforcement drones by September of 2015 at the latest, and in the case of law enforcement, to do it on an expedited basis. So we are trying to alert the American public to this upcoming opening of the airspace and to get them to be calling their police departments, expressing their desire for their police departments not to have drones, and passing local legislation saying we do not want drones being used in our community to violate the privacy of the American people.
So you're trying to raise consciousness and awareness, and also, of course, to stimulate mobilization of energies to combat the development and use of drones. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the underreported, as always, activities of anti-war people, both in the United States and in other countries in relation to the drones.
Well, in a case like Pakistan, there's millions of people who have been protesting the drones. They get out by the hundreds of thousands in protests on the street. They've done citizens outside the bases of the U.S. Bases in Pakistan. And the government there, the legislature, has voted several times to demand that the U.S. stop the drone strikes, but that's to no avail. Here in the United States, there have been groups like my organization, Code Pink, other groups like Catholic Workers, Veterans for Peace, that have been doing protests at bases, Air Force bases, where the pilots are being trained or the pilots are actually remotely controlling the drones. At several of these bases, people have risked arrest, crossing the line onto the base as part of the protest, using their trials as a way to get out these issues about the breaking of international law. And then there's folks who've been doing protests in front of the headquarters of the drone manufacturers or at the homes of the CEOs, and we're encouraging stepping up of that those kinds of activities. And there's also a trip we have planned to Pakistan in October that's open to the public to try to do a peace march to the region in northern Pakistan where the drones are being used to kill so many innocent people.
You mention as well in this context using the parallel of the treaty for banning landmines. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Yes, since the U.S. is out of control with its use of lethal drones, we have to look towards the international community to try to regulate the use of lethal drones. And so people are modeling their campaigns after the campaigns to ban landmines, where the Canadians were so central to that campaign. It's going to be harder in the case of lethal drones because it is such a big business. And because there are non-lethal uses of these drones. But we think it's important to try, and we hope that there will be some Canadians and Canadian government officials who can help us in this process. As we know, for most of the banning of these weapons, it never comes from the United States. It comes from outside. And even though the U.S. doesn't sign on to these treaties in most cases, the global community can shame the U.S. into stopping the use of these weapons.
You earlier made reference to what I would call the big lie that underpins recent decades of war making, namely that we're defending ourselves against a terrorist threat. It binds together that kind of propaganda, binds together Obama and Bush and Blair and Cameron and the rest of the gang. In your work to oppose drones, how do you try to counter that propaganda of the terrorist threat?
Well, we say that whoever attacked us on 9/11, according to our government, they seem to have killed just about everybody who was involved in that attack. And now what they're doing is creating new enemies, that every time there is a drone strike, there are more people who want to join the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. I give examples in the book and also in my talks that show how counterproductive this drone strategy is, that it creates more enemies than we could possibly kill, not only in places like Pakistan, where the vast majority of Pakistanis have now become anti-American, even though when, at the time Obama was elected, they had great hopes for a new change in policy. And also how if we didn't have our troops in Afghanistan, there wouldn't be people in Afghanistan and in Pakistan trying to kill American soldiers. And in the case of Yemen, we can see how in the beginnings of the drone strikes under the Obama administration, there were perhaps, generously speaking, 200 people identified as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and they held no territory. Now there's over 1,000, and they hold significant territory. And U.S. government officials have admitted that they have taken an internal struggle inside Yemen and are now turning it into an international one because of our drone strikes.
Well, thank you very much for your book, for your organizing work, and thanks for speaking with us this morning, Medea.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Our guest has been Medea Benjamin. She's a co-founder of the peace group Code Pink, and she's a tireless activist for social justice. Medea Benjamin is the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Her book is published by OR Books, that's O-R Books, and their website is exactly that, orbooks.com.